This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Henry Petrosky is fascinated by disasters. The sinking of the Titanic, for instance, was a tragedy, yes, but it also is an important lesson in hubris and poor planning. Same goes for the explosions of the space shuttles Challenger and Columbia. These weren't simple failures of engineering. They were complex malfunctions involving quite a bit of human error. To Henry Petrosky, the bridge represents the purest form of engineering. What you see is what you get. In most cases, there are no frills. It's all meant to be very practical. And yet, time and again, bridges fail, and they fall into the water, they crash to the ground beneath them, they even claim lives. Why? Henry Petrosky is a professor in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department at Duke University. His most recent book is To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure, and he joins us now to talk about it. Henry Petrosky, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So have you always been interested in this sort of thing, catastrophe as a way of understanding design?
No, I don't think so. My first book was published in 1985, and in the course of writing that book, I think I discovered the importance of disaster and failure in understanding engineering. The working title of that book was What is Engineering? And I wrote it because I didn't know that I myself understood engineering. I had 3 degrees in engineering. I was teaching engineering. I had worked as an engineer. I was registered as a professional engineer. And yet, when some of my colleagues at Duke would ask me, especially colleagues in the humanities departments, why is it that you engineers make these mistakes and there are so many failures? And that got me thinking about the problems that we do have. Why do things go wrong?
Well, go ahead. Please finish.
To me, engineering is fundamentally about design, making things. One distinction between a scientist and an engineer is that the scientist wants to understand what is out there, the given world or the made world, whereas the engineer wants to create new things, make the world even more populated with things and devices and so forth. And in trying to design those things, the engineer, above all, wants to make sure they don't fail, wants to make sure they work. And the way you do make sure that things work positively, that they're successes, is that that you guide against failure, you guard against failure, you design against failure, you anticipate failure.
And you test also. I mean, to a certain extent, you sort of have a theory and then you work things out a little bit. So there's a little bit of guidance in the fund of knowledge that you bring to the project. Then you put it on the bench and it doesn't work and you fix that part, right?
Well, that's right. And that's failure. That tells you a lot more than if it works. If it works, you don't know how far from failure it is, for example. So there's a lot more information in a failure than there is in a success.
The anniversary of the Titanic disaster just passed. Tell us about this particular failure, how it happened, and how really human arrogance was a big part of the failure of the unsinkable Titanic.
That's right. The Titanic on her maiden voyage was thought to be unsinkable, or at least marketed as being unsinkable. But as we know, marketing often takes over the conversation. And the captain had a lot of confidence in the ship and in himself, evidently, was going at a pretty good clip. It was known that there was ice in the area. And conditions were such that by the time they saw the iceberg that did them in, it was too late to steer totally clear of it, and it cut a big gash in the side of the hull. It's still debated to some extent exactly what happened, but it seems clear from discoveries that have been made of the wreckage that the rivets were weak, and the rivets were sheared off by the grazing of the iceberg, and this opened up the steel plates that the hull was made up of, and this let in a lot of water. The ship did have bulkheads, but the bulkheads didn't compartmentalize completely. And as a result, when the water got into one of the chambers defined by the bulkheads, it overtopped the bulkheads, and it kept progressing back further and further, and eventually the ship sank.
What was it about the design, assuming that it wasn't all public relations? There were advances in shipbuilding represented in the ship. What were they? What was better about this ship that led anybody to call it unsinkable?
I'm not sure that there was that much that was better than it. It was bigger. You know, its name implies what was more different about it. These bulkheads were incomplete, as I've indicated, and all engineering, all design has to anticipate certain limits. And in the case of the Titanic, it appears that it wasn't ever anticipated that six bulkheads would be exposed to the water. And that really revealed its weakness. I like to speculate what would have happened had the Titanic not sunk, which I think is an interesting thought experiment. And we can speculate that if the Titanic had reached New York safely, as it well might have, because after all, it really was only a coincidence of the ship being in the same place as the iceberg, that if the Titanic had reached New York safely and, in fact, continued back and forth across the North Atlantic for years, if not decades, what would have been the consequences of that? Very likely, competing steamship companies would have said, well, we've got to outdo the Titanic. We've got to make our ships bigger. We've got to drive them faster. We don't have any incidents with iceberg. Let's make the hulls thinner, less steel. That'll make them cheaper to build. We'll have a better profit margin. And if ships never sink, why do we need lifeboats at all? So we'll get rid of all of them. In other words, the consequences of a success can be really detrimental to the genre of whatever it is we're talking about. And you add to that the overconfidence that success brings, the hubris, and so forth. So the failure of the Titanic, in a way, did more good than its success might have. That's a very ironic way of looking at it, but...
No, but instructive. I think you're right. I mean, think about the fact that they may have said, well, let's make the steel this thick because nothing will penetrate that. And of course, over time, when nothing does, when you don't even have the accident, you think, well, why are we making it that thick? And so over time, it's the fact that you haven't had the accident and haven't even encountered the original fear, the original obstacle that allows you to degrade the quality or make compromises. That's one
exactly
of the things you suggest.
Yes.
But the other thing is to talk about the speed, because you mentioned that the captain was going at a pretty good clip. I mean, what part of that, and it was water in which he may have encountered icebergs. It wasn't as though it was a real surprise to see them there, right?
Well, that's right. He thought he was going a little south of the icebergs, the main iceberg field, but he knew that there had been icebergs sighted in the mm-hmm. area, so he really should have exercised a little more caution. There have been some theories that have been coming out recently that say, well, atmospheric conditions were such that night that visibility was affected significantly, so that even if you did have excellent outlook,
right, visibility,
what do you call them?
Visibility.
People up on the watchers, those that are supposed to see the iceberg.
Right.
Even if you had people that had a lot of experience and great eyesight, the weather conditions were such that they were hampered.
But what are the chances he was going faster than he should have because he was driving an unsinkable ship? He believed the PR, right?
That's right. And also, that would just imagine if the Titanic had broken a speed record on her maiden voyage. That just adds to the marketing value of it.
That said, these accidents are still happening. I mean, the Costa Concordia accident not long ago. So do we learn from these accidents?
Well, unfortunately, we learn to a limited extent. The general experience is that we remember these things for a few years, but then they begin to fade out of consciousness. We remember them at anniversaries, like centennials, for example. In the case of the Costa Concordia, that happened a few months before the Titanic centennial. So as a result, it wasn't being talked about that much. Even if it were, the captain of the Concordia may not have heeded the lessons. He was going dangerously close to land. It was not the authorized route that he was taking. Evidently, and I guess, there still has to be trial and findings, but allegedly he wanted to show his passengers, or at least some passengers, the thrill of going close to land and being able to see the lights of the city, and wanted to also salute the town by, shooting off the horn and so forth.
Yeah.
So there was this bravado, and at the same time thinking that, well, nothing's going to go wrong. I've got sonar, I've got radar, things that the Titanic didn't have. So again, we have this overconfidence, this human element. And by the time that the rocks ahead were known to be there on the ship, it was too late to actually steer this great ship, because it takes a long time to change its course.
Yeah. Well, this is a matter, of course, for the psychologist, not so much the engineer, why it is we can't keep in memory those disasters that so shocked us in the immediate aftermath that it moved us to action. Social engineering, the same thing. We had all kinds of great mechanisms in place, economic and financial mechanisms, to protect us against a depression. And over time, we got a little bit confident, took them out, and then 2008, it's worse than 1930, because we forgot that you need protection, you need regulation.
Exactly. And the human element, obviously, is the common factor here.
So, and I think writ large in the Challenger, and the particularly the Challenger and the Columbia disasters. Mm-hmm. I mean, here, NASA is no engineering group on Earth is probably more safety conscious than the ever public relations conscious NASA, and yet those disasters happened.
Yes. Well, it's very interesting. Before the shuttle program even really got off the ground, the engineers who had been working on the designs were asked, well, what do we think is the reliability of this machine? How often are we going to have a failure that actually cost us lives of astronauts? And the engineers estimated, and this is just really an educated guess, but they said, oh, about 1 in 100. The managers, on the other hand, were asked the same question effectively, and they said, oh, 1 in 100,000. Yeah. So right away, you can see a discrepancy between how engineers look at these things and how management
How did either of them come up with their estimates?
Well, the way this is done, if it's done carefully, basically we have a new machine, a space shuttle. But at the same time, it bears a lot of resemblance to aircraft that had flown. So you have historic evidence, you have historic records of failures and accidents and what can go wrong. You know the various components that go into the machine, and you can make a pretty good estimate of how often, let's say, a wing's going to fall off. That virtually doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But how often can, let's say, the computer fail? That's a more likely type of failure. So this you concatenate all of these various possibilities, and you can come to a number. This is actually done.
It sounds awfully difficult, though, when you consider not only the complex systems themselves, because it's not just a computer. Mm-hmm. It's a network of computers. Right. And then there's a network of valves and nozzles. And then there's a network of apparatus and hoses and exhaust, all of which, you know, each can have their own sort of rate of failure. And they're related. They're connected.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the big debates that goes on in engineering in some cases, that, well, we can test all the different components and we can say, they're all very reliable, but what happens to the whole system when they're all working together, as you indicate? That's a very important point.
And that's when we really need this sort of actuarial evidence. That's when we look at how many planes go up and how many planes fall down, and then we can compute the likelihood that you're going to be in an airplane accident.
That's right, yeah.
Well, so let's talk about those in particular. First, the Challenger accident. I mean, there's one that really wasn't a failure in engineering. They knew that those O-rings, if they get too cold, won't compress and they won't be seals anymore. And they lifted off when it was too cold.
Well, that's exactly right. The engineers warned the management, if you will, because management was, you know, had the final say in whether to go or not. And the engineers begged them really not to launch on that morning. But the managers, having pressure of different kinds, including political pressure, evidently, went.
Yeah, the president was going to make a speech that night, and they wanted him to be able to point to the successful launch of the Challenger.
Exactly. So there are these external pressures. And, you know, you can argue that, well, you do have to take those things into account. That's part of the whole system, after all. And the Challenger had flown on several occasions with imperfect seals and had returned safely. So it wasn't an absolute that it was going to fail. And it was a judgment call in the end, but the judgment was wrong. Engineers tend to be more conservative than managers, let's say.
And what about Columbia? To remind us about what happened there and tell us how it happened.
Well, Columbia, when it took off, when it was launched, there was a piece of foam, insulating foam, that came loose from the external tank. And it hit the foredge of the wing of the shuttle. These pieces of foam had been coming off really throughout the shuttle program. So that was not what was unusual. What was unusual was that it hit the foredge of the wing. And the engineer said, well, you know, maybe it could do some damage. Some people, management types, were saying, but it's just a light piece of foam. You know, what can it do? Well, engineers know that it's not just the weight or the mass of something, but it's also the velocity which it hits. Well, anyway, the space shuttle Columbia did get launched and did go into orbit properly, and everything seemed to be, you know, working. But there was this question, was it damaged? Would it be able to return safely to Earth? The engineers, as I understand the story, begged the management to let's inspect this thing. Let's get really high-resolution photographs of it, or let's even do a spacewalk. But they were denied that. So the shuttle came in, return to Earth, came into the atmosphere in an unknown state, really. And as you know, as everybody knows, they're monitored as they fly along, and it became clear that something was wrong. And eventually, there was too much hot plasma gas getting into the wing and beginning to deteriorate the structure, and the whole space shuttle Columbia basically disintegrated upon reentry.
I'm talking with Henry Petrosky, a professor in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department at Duke University. His most recent book is To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. Just ahead, he's going to tell us why bridges are the purest form of architecture. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today with Henry Petrosky about why engineering sometimes fails. He's a professor in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department at Duke University. His most recent book is To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. Henry Petrosky, you consider bridges the purest form of engineering, and you spend a lot of time in your book talking about them. Why?
Well, to me, bridges are pure engineering. Unlike buildings, let's say, where you have an architect putting a facade over the structure, or in many cases, a structure actually being built behind a facade, which is what sells the building in the first place. Mm-hmm. Bridges are not like that. You see what you get. Very often, you can see how they work exactly. You can see the suspenders, the cables, the roadway, the deck. It's all there. Mm-hmm. It's what engineers and architects call exposed structure. So I like them for that reason. I also like them because they're more pure engineering. And also, I like to talk about bridges because there's such a deep history about not only bridges themselves, going back to ancient times that have actually been written about, but also the failures of bridges. And the evolution of bridges, why they change over time, has generally been in response to failure or to problems. So it's a very clear system that can be followed, and every new failure can be put into a context.
And they still do fail, and given the fact that we don't have to compromise over any kind of cosmetic design, that's surprising. The case of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, for instance, in your book, a dramatic failure captured on film. Tell us about that.
Well, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge was to go over an arm of Puget Sound at a narrow place called the Narrows, but it was still about a mile wide. So you needed a major bridge to cross over this, and it had to be high enough to allow ocean-going ships to pass under it. Well, the state of Washington had its highway department, and highway engineers from the state designed a suspension bridge. But as is fairly typical when you're doing a big project like that, you call in consultants, you call in experts, people that have had experience with structures of that kind, not just once, but many times over. And the consultant that was called in, his name was Leon Wasiev. We're talking about the 1930s, roughly. He had worked on just about every major suspension bridge since the turn of the century. So he had three decades of real solid experience. He was the expert. He had written the theories. He had published the papers. He was revered among all the engineering community. Well, in this period, in the 1930s, there was something happening in the bridge building community, and that was there was a change in fashion. Engineering goes by fads and fashions, and it's just like everything else does. And the new fashion had been that you want a bridge, especially a suspension bridge, you want its roadway to look as slender as possible. So you want it to not be very deep, you don't want a lot of steel under it messing up the way it looks. So you want it long and slender. Well, that was the trend. And Moiseyev said, well, we're going to make this bridge a real aesthetic model. Not only that, it was going to be the third longest suspension bridge in the world, after only the Golden Gate and the George Washington Bridge in New York City. They were respectively about 4,200 feet between the towers, 3,500 feet between the towers, and the Tacoma Narrows was going to be 2,800 feet between them. So we're talking about a really major structure here. At the same time, it was being built in a location that was relatively unpopulated then. So you didn't need a lot of lanes of traffic. In fact, you only needed one each way. Well, that meant it was also going to be a very narrow bridge. So you got this combination of a very long, very narrow, very shallow bridge. Well, that's sort of like, let's say, a yardstick compared to a 2x4. It's very flexible. You can twist it. You can bend it. And that's exactly what happened with this bridge. Shortly after it opened, it began to undulate, move up and down, bend up and down in waves. So that if you're seeing one part of the bridge, you'd be up, the other part next to it might be down, and it just kept going like waves in the sea. And that went on for about 4 months, and people gained confidence. They said, well, you know, it's happening. We didn't expect it to happen. We're not sure exactly why it's happening, but it doesn't look like it's dangerous.
It sure sounds like it's dangerous, but you go ahead.
Well, there were about three or four other bridges that were contemporary with this that had the same problem. And none of them had failed, collapsed. But then suddenly, in November of 1940, after doing this for 4 months, the bridge suddenly did something different. It started twisting from side to side. And that had not been experienced before in any other bridge in modern history. So people began to get a little more worried. That's when they got their cameras out. This was news. Not only news for the newspaper, but also news for the engineering research community. What's really going on here? Well, that happened. That motion continued for about 4 hours, but then that, of course, started breaking up the concrete in the roadway, and that made the bridge even less stiff and more flexible. So it began to move even more. And eventually it just tore itself apart and collapsed into the water. So that was a real shock. Now, one thing that's very interesting about this is that 100 years earlier, back in the 1840s, a similar situation had arisen. There were a lot of suspension bridges back then. They were smaller. They generally were not made of steel or iron. They were made of timber, the roadway at least. And they misbehaved in the wind. They did a lot of this, and some of them even collapsed. The British basically said, well, you know, these suspension bridges aren't very reliable. We're not going to use them anymore, especially for the new fangled railroad trains. So the British came up with all sorts of unusual bridge designs. But the Americans in the person of John Roebling, who was a German immigrant to the United States and a bridge builder from Germany, his education in Germany taught him about bridge building. He began to study all the failures. He said, well, okay, we know they're happening. Why are they happening? And by studying them and by looking at them as a class, he deduced that, well, yes, the wind is very important. You have to really design against the wind. And he came up and he designed a bridge, and it completed in 1854, across the Niagara Gorge, just downriver from Niagara Falls, that not only withstood the wind, but also was able to support railroad trains, this is the first suspension bridge in the world to support a railroad train. And he said, and people asked him, especially the British, because they had said you couldn't do this, well, how did you do this, John Roebling? He said, well, there are three things. He said, I made the roadway, the deck, massive enough so that it's got a lot of inertia, so that if the wind comes in gusts, it's not going to move it. That's for one thing. Mm-hmm. He said, at the same time, I made it very stiff so that the wind or even the traffic or the railroad trains, it's not going to bend it very much. It's going to stay straight and level. He said, furthermore, I'm going to worry about what we'd call today turbulence. We've all experienced turbulence in an airplane, and it can be very violent. I mean, we can, you know, you sure want your seatbelt.
This is not a particular sustained kind of wind, but a draft, a quick burst of up and down. Yeah.
And so he said, well, you've got to tie the roadway down with cables. And those were his three. That was his formula, basically. Well, he's the one who conceived of the Brooklyn Bridge, and that was his masterpiece. And everybody that knows the Brooklyn Bridge knows that it's got a massive roadway. It's very wide. Anytime it's wide, it's heavy and massive. And it's very stiff. He's got what engineers call trusses, all these triangles of steel that make something stiff, typical bridge stiffening device. And it also has its diagonal cables. This is one of the hallmarks of the Brooklyn Bridge, that coming down from the stone towers are these cables that go contrary to the vertical. They come at diagonals. And you can always tell the Brooklyn Bridge by that, and it gives it its character. Well, that was 1883 when the Brooklyn Bridge was completed. After that, people were emboldened. This is a great success. So designing suspension bridges became a challenge to make them longer and more slender and so forth. At first, they took away his diagonal cables. That's like a belt and suspenders, they said. Why do you need both of these things? You've got this main suspension cable that's holding the bridge roadway up. Let's get rid of those diagonals. And after that, they began to say, this heavy truss work, all these diagonals, that's distracting aesthetically. Let's do away with that. And then the Tacoma Narrows Bridge did away with the last thing, and that was the mast, the weight of the bridge in its width, principally. So systematically, they chopped away at all these conservatisms that Roebling had built into his bridge. And the Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapsed in 1940, about 100 years to the day from when John Roebling wrote in a journal you had to do to have a safe suspension bridge.
But, you know, you just described in a kind of a narrative way the way engineers whittle away at the safety features. You know, well, why do we need that? Well, it doesn't look pretty. But I'm still shocked. Isn't there some math? I mean, it seems to me basic physics and metallurgy. There's a way of applying so much pressure or so much velocity against this much mass with this kind of tensile strength and a computer model that could have set the whole thing up. I mean, don't we know how to do that?
We do know how to do that, except there's one problem, and that is in building these bridges, and we'll just stick with bridges to be concrete. When you go into a new regime, like when you go into something that's more slender than anything before, then it's not clear that those formulas hold anymore. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. Or even computer programs that are based on those formulas, because you're going into a new regime. And this has been known. The oldest engineering book in history is Vitruvius, the Roman architect/engineer who wrote in the first century BC, and he observed this. Something that works on the small scale doesn't necessarily work on the larger scale, because new phenomena come in. And that basically means that you need new formulas in modern terminology. Galileo recognized this back in the 17th century when he was banned from writing about the heavens. He said, well, I'll think about mundane things like, why do obelisks break when we move them? Why do ships sometimes fall apart upon being launched? And what he concluded was there was a size. When they passed a certain size, suddenly things that we knew before didn't seem to apply anymore. And he observed that nature had a different point of view. He said, let's look at two animals that are, you know, occur in nature. And let's look at, for the sake of argument, one animal that's three times the size of the other. He says, if we look at two corresponding bones, one will be three times as long as the other, but it won't be three times as thick. It'll be much more thick, out of proportion thick. He said, there's something that nature knows that we don't know. Because up until then, all of design was, well, you just do it geometrically larger.
Sure.
And that was their formula.
In all proportions.
Proportions.
And this is where Galileo and others have recognized it doesn't work proportionally. So in a sense, whenever we're moving beyond new frontiers, we're always creating new engineering formulas. And ultimately, it comes down to this. It's how much we know and how smart we are as engineers, but also our appetite for risk against the ability to pay for a safer and safer, whatever it is, a bridge or a boat. I mean, all of those things become the system that ultimately judges the kind of engineering we get.
Very well said.
Henry Petrosky, pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
Henry Petrosky is a professor in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department at Duke University. His most recent book is To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. And that's the state of things for today. If you have a comment about our show or you want to hear an archived edition of a past program, our website is stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.